Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. We're recording this on April 27th, 2017, and this is episode 31. Politicos is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, whatever it's still calling itself, or any other place you can find podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicos Pod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian. Before we get started tonight, we actually have a bit of an announcement. We're going to be hosting a election night party at Jaeger's on Pender Street in downtown Vancouver. You can join us there on Tuesday, May 9th after 7 p.m. roughly. And we'll potentially do a bit of live recording if we can figure that out and make it work. If not, we'll just have a bunch of beers and talk politics. The polls close at 8 p.m., so most of the results will probably come in between 10 and 11. So I hope you can be there. You can RSVP on our Facebook page and find more details. And if this goes really successful, we'll hopefully try to do more politics and pub nights. So let us know if you're interested but just can't come. And let's give a quick awkward shout out to the Vancouver Public Library, where we're cramped in their tiny little recording studio. So hopefully this sounds a little more professional because this kit is much nicer than the little like microphone I have just sitting on my desk usually. But don't get used to it, because next week we'll go back to little microphones on desks. Well, the first segment today is La La Plans. The big televised debate was last night, and we actually both sat through it and watched the whole thing. I definitely needed a beer before and after and during that, but what did you think?
I honestly don't think it really changed things very much. Everyone more or less did what they needed to, but there was no knockout punches or big moments that'll be talked about. No, if you don't show up to your job, you don't get a promotion. No, you had a choice. No, math is hard. None of these like big, famous debate moments in Canadian politics happened last night.
Well, that's sort of the typical of most debates. We don't actually get knockout punches on every debate we watch. What I found really interesting about this debate was just the format was actually a lot better than most debates. They had three people up there, but they only really ever had two of them interact at once, so you got to do a lot of contrasting and comparing. So that worked a lot better than like the first radio debate where it was just everyone yelling, or it was John Horgan yelling over everyone, let's be honest. But this gave sort of a nice, you know, let's compare John Horgan and Christy Clark. Let's compare John Horgan and Andrew Weaver. Let's compare Andrew Weaver and Christy Clark. And that's literally all the three matchups you can have. But then just in terms of how they were positioned, even that I think worked a little bit better for almost everyone. Like John Horgan didn't have to have Christy Clark right beside him because they were at opposite ends of the stage.
They were more than an arm's length apart, so no touching happened.
Yeah, there was none of that. Andrew Weaver got to stand in the middle and like have that visual representation of himself as the moderate centrist option, and he could repeatedly go, on the right of me, they'll talk about corporate donations, and on the left of me, they'll talk about union donations, but I'm getting rid of them all.
Although he did screw up his left and right at one point.
Yeah,
maybe he was doing stage left, but it didn't come across well.
Well, it was still a nice like visual frame for him, so he had that going at the very minimum. The moderator actually did really well, too, although I thought she was talking kind of slowly and just a lot about stuff, but so I can't tell if she was actually good at moderating or just everyone like treated her respectfully, which is rare. Like usually they just start going off and into their own realm.
Yeah, I thought it would have helped if she was maybe a little more forceful and, you know, interjected in the exchanges where it's just Weaver and Horgan yelling at each other for 5 minutes. But other than that, yeah, she did a pretty good job. I think better than the moderator in the first debate, which kind of interjected his own opinions into it.
Yeah, this one was very scripted on her behalf. She even at one point said, Mr. Andrew Weaver, what do you actually prefer? And he's just like, I don't care. I'm so chill. You can call me Andrew, which is the sort of forced response you have to give as a politician. So she's just like, no, but seriously, what do you want to be called? And he's like, whatever. She's like, okay, I'm going to call you Mr. Weaver because that's what's written here. And we're just going to stick to the script. But let's get into a bit more of the performance. I found right off the start, everyone was awkward and nervous, which was weird. Like, I got that Andrew Weaver was nervous because this was his, like, I think he had the highest bar to sort of meet. He had to not be crazy. And he reached that. But there was
well,
so much.
One would consider that the lowest bar one should have to cross.
Sure. he had a lot to achieve tonight, but he sort of stuttered a bit in the intro, didn't look super confident, referred to his notes a lot. None of that says he would be a bad sort of premier or has bad policies, but in the sort of televised nature we live
in. The performance art aspect was probably his weakest spot, especially compared to the other two leaders. And you know, like it or not, there is a certain amount of performance required in a debate, not just policy.
And then even in the opening statements, John Horgan and Christy Clark were both also a little bit off. Like Christy Clark, who has decades of radio experience and just being in the media spotlight, sort of stuttered a bit, felt a little uncomfortable. I mean, they all improved through the night. By the end, John Horgan was just like right into the camera, just smiling and giving his lines. Christy Clark about the same. Although I noticed like every time she talked, she just looked straight at the camera. Even when someone asked her a question, she's like, thank you. All right, back to the camera. Whereas Andrew Weaver sort of like kept his gaze on whoever he was talking to. So he spent a lot of the time talking to the moderator. Just, you know, those little things that in terms of the performance art you're talking about, he isn't quite there.
But in terms of the actual substantive answers, I thought he probably did the best out of the three. I always was able to refer back to, you know, a detailed policy position of the Greens. And that was something I thought Horgan was a little weak on, is he'd go on the attack and maybe stick a little bit of NDP policy at the end if he felt like it.
The policy of the Greens is much denser and less on the platitudes than the others. That's both because they're the Greens who spend a lot of time thinking, and probably because they're also less of the professional political party.
In terms of what Weaver had to do, he definitely did come out solid, grounded, and presented the Greens as a viable party with good ideas that's basically ready to govern. And out of a completely non-scientific sample of two of my roommates and one random guy I met for the first time when a roommate invited him over last night, they all kind of went from, the Greens, they're a bunch of, you know, nutty people, care about the environment and only that, to, you know what, I'm going to give them a chance. So in terms of that, I think he did fairly well on that.
What we commented on after his first debate was he sort of sat in the corner and let the others talk away. In this one, he did step it up. We said he needed more energy, and that definitely came out. He was passionate. At some points, I saw on Twitter people going, maybe he's getting a little too John Horgan-esque in terms of the like yelling. And like the first interchange between two leaders was between Horgan and Weaver, and it was like vitriolic and angry and loud to the point when neither of them were getting points across. They were just sort of yelling.
There was one exchange where I basically had no idea what either of them said just because they were both loudly talking over each other.
So almost turned it up a little too much. And Horgan did turn it down, I think.
Not nearly enough, but a bit.
So I guess we got the debate we were asking for, although Christy Clark definitely sort of kept herself out of it. In terms of that positioning I was talking about, she had the sort of corner to, you know, let the two men yell at each other. Well, she just sort of smiled and said, I'm the adult in the room, which plays for that base she wants.
Yeah, Weaver definitely spent more time going after Horgan on a lot of issues than Clark. And on one hand, that does make sense, because the Green Party's path to victory is going to come at the expense of a lot of NDP seats. That's where they're looking to make their biggest gains on the island. And the easy swing ridings for the Greens are ones that the NDP currently holds. So it made sense that Weaver's going to focus on that. But it does also occasionally seem to be too much of a focus versus the current premier. And you kind of saw this in the last federal election, too, where the fight for the change vote was almost tougher than the fight against the current government.
And so if that's Weaver's performance tonight, Horgan, between the two of them, they brought on a lot of attack on Christy Clark. I think she actually fared sort of the poorest out of the debate, and every sort of post-debate poll suggests that. And there was the Main Street poll, which was mostly people who were already decided who they're voting for, saying that person did really well, although Weaver did a little bit better among the undecideds and even some of the cross-partisans. And even our own sort of very unscientific Twitter poll found that half of the 84 people who voted thought Christy Clark did the worst, versus 37% for John Horgan and 13% for Dr. Weaver. But so when they were bringing the criticisms on Clark, she was doing bad, and I think she lost a lot of ground. She wasn't able to deflect as many of them as strongly as I think people were expecting.
Or she did last time, for example.
Yeah, even the previous debate. But then when Horgan and Weaver sort of started going after each other, that's when it became really good news for Christy Clark. She could just sort of lean back and smile, and everything goes well for her at that point. So it's sort of a mixed bag for how the whole night went for her.
Yeah, there's a moment during one of the Horgan-Weaver exchanges where they were going back and forth and who had the biggest rally, which was probably the low moment of the night. And, you know, Clark got a good, I'm not going to compare rally sizes with you, Dr. Weaver.
It was incredibly, this was like right after they were screaming at each other. So, oh, it was sad. I think I tweeted about, like, they're just going to whip it out now, aren't they? Which,
now, granted, it's a slight, very slight step up from the Republican primary debate when they were comparing sizes on something a little less abstract, but it was definitely a low point in the debate.
But it went up from there. The later halves were better. I think one of John Horgan's strongest points was when he was talking about education, sort of public services. They had the leaders each ask one another questions throughout the night. I found those like really well framed. Usually they're a lot more sort of just talking, but not a question, but they did end with a solid question. Horgan's question was, Christy Clark, you've basically had a decade of cutting education. Will you apologize to this lost generation of kids? Which was just like so sharp and pointed that she kind of almost stuttered for a second and went, thanks for the question, John. Education's important, and I'm investing in it. Which he can then pointed out that it's sort of court-mandated investing. Although she, I think her stronger rebuttal there was, you're not bringing any additional money, are you? And it's one of those tough things where I think the NDP is thinking about bringing more, but they don't want to like pre-negotiate a contract with the union, which is going to obviously ask for whatever the NDP says, plus like 25%. But then the Greens have offered that already. So this has been an interesting election so far. But if Horgan's strength was on education, he got hit a few times by that recent story about the United Steelworkers who are basically funding his campaign staff. This is sort of the thing Clark kept coming back to as the attack on Horgan.
And Weaver a few times as well.
And I found that at least Clark's attack pretty hypocritical, because even right at, and it was only at the end that Horgan finally started counting up all the different lobbyists who were funding the BC Liberals and saying, well, where's all those influences coming in? And then Andrew Weaver brings in the big Ski Hill conglomerate that's apparently lobbying for Family Day to be when it is, which was a highlight of the night, in my honesty. I didn't actually expect anyone to bring up the big Ski Hill lobby or know that even existed in BC, but considering how poor most Ski Hills actually do, they run pretty thin margins. I guess they can't afford lobbyists.
Yeah, both of them were going after the steelworkers' ties, and I think that was perhaps more damaging than normal right after the softwood lumber, because the United Steelworkers, the American branch of that, was lobbying pretty strongly for softwood lumber tariffs. So it definitely does present the kind of who are you actually working for argument, and in a fairly damning way. And that's always been one of the NDP's kind of weak points, is the closeness with unions to the point where it's actually a formal part of the NDP organization.
Andrew Weaver was able to bring up the, well, I've stopped taking the corporate and union donations, which Horgan sort of threw back the, well, 6 months ago you did, but it's not like the Greens were getting that much prior to that, although now they could theoretically be getting some moderate to sizable donations. Companies like to pad the pockets of any party with a chance of getting into power. So Horgan's big pitch was, and this even came in one direct question to him, how can people trust that you'll cut these ties with unions? And he talked about how, you know, the first act he'll bring in will be the end of corporate and union donations, and he's done bills on that 6 times. I thought he could have gone a bit stronger and just sort of pointed next door. He could have just said, look, the Alberta NDP campaigned on exactly this, and they did exactly that. But I think there's almost this just this bad blood now between Alberta and BC NDP, so that they can't really reference each other as much as they almost would otherwise.
Yeah, Horgan did overall fairly well, but he still, I don't think, really nailed the temperamental aspect of it. He, as we said, toned it down a bit, but he was still pretty dickish about how he approached the other candidates on the stage and really wouldn't let anyone get a word in edgewise on this one. And I think that's probably going to hurt him a bit, because he definitely did not appear to be, you know, the sort of level-headed person you want as premier.
And the moderator asked him point blank about sort of his temperament. Is he too angry? And he talked about how he sometimes considers himself to be mercurial, I guess, meaning maybe in his mind, emotional or passionate, when it could also just mean unstable. I think people were tweeting that definition on Twitter a little bit more because it's a little less flattering. But his sort of fallback is to talk about, yes, it's right to get angry and passionate about the sort of corruption, injustice, scandals, whatever you want to talk about. Like, when he's getting passionate and angry, as it were, about education, teachers and people who support sort of the public education system, I think are seeing the champion they want. It's just when he talks over Christy Clark, when she's like, please stop interrupting me, that doesn't come off good to anyone.
No, it really doesn't. And look, you know, the part on education was probably his strongest point of the night, but yeah, it is a little undercut everywhere else when he's interrupting people asking him not to interrupt.
One of the sharpest questions the moderator threw at Clark was just, after all these sort of scandals and all this political financing issues, how will you convince voters to trust you? And she just sort of smiled and went, I think voters care about jobs, and just like went off in a 90-degree direction and just started talking about the economy and jobs and how scary the NDP was, and spent a lot of time throughout the night talking about the 90s NDP, which I'm sure appeals to, like, the subset of her base, which is old enough to have voted in both of those elections in 91 and 96. And I guess that's sort of who she has to play to. But it does sort of open her to being mocked as, why are you still obsessed with, like, 20, 30 years ago when the last 16 years are all on you?
Yeah, blaming the previous government is a time-honored Canadian political tradition, but usually that dies out around a third mandate. But yeah, there's a few things on her part that didn't make a whole lot of sense. Her position on carbon taxes and, well, housing taxes as well was entirely nonsensical, in that she'd attack the Greens or the NDP for wanting to raise the carbon tax or increase taxes to deter speculation, well, though not phrased that way, but then at the same time, shortly after, just bragged about the leadership the BC Liberal showed by bringing in the carbon tax or bringing in the 15% foreign buyers tax. And, well, which is it? Is it either good that these were brought in, or is it a bad thing that's going to destroy BC?
Well, and Horgan asked her about why won't she consider even expanding this foreign buyers tax beyond Vancouver. And she's like, excuse me, it applies to all of Metro Vancouver from Langley to the coast, which was such a non-answer. Like, I think it was maybe the biggest non-answer of the night. Like, the province is bigger than that, and she should know, because most of her caucus is from outside that circle that everyone sort of hates who doesn't live here.
Yeah, it was almost a you forgot about Poland moment from the 2004 presidential debate, where Kerry was attacking Bush over the lackluster alliance that went into Iraq and how they, you know, weren't able to get international support. He listed off a few countries, you know, Britain, Australia, and this, but he forgot about Poland, and Bush made a point of pointing that out, and it was basically the same thing, but, you know, you forgot about Langley.
Yeah.
It was just a weird answer to that. That was a complete non-answer.
And so all of this comes off of earlier in the week when Main Street and another polling company, I don't remember exactly who, had a couple looks, snapshots of the election, and they put the NDP actually up. Main Street was most notable because they put the NDP a full 10 points ahead of the BC Liberals. It was one of those cases where the Liberals kind of dropped about 3 or 4 and the NDP gained 3 or 4. All the changes were within statistical significance, but the sort of net is potentially a shift. And that starts to form a narrative, like, are the NDP starting to run away with this? Or not even run away with it, but opening it up enough. Whereas in the previous election, the trends were all the other way. The NDP was slipping through the whole thing. They were still in the lead days before, but the trend line had been pointing towards maybe things weren't going Adrian Dix's way. So right now we had the polls a few days ago suggesting the NDP are on the upswing, the Liberals are sort of losing ground, the Greens are at least holding their position, potentially gaining a
couple points.
Yeah, it's hard to tell when, you know, it's all within 17 to 22%. And so this debate, I don't think, shifts any of those narratives, which overall is probably bad for Clark, good for the others. John Horgan didn't take so many hits, I think, that people who were sort of on the fence about him before moved off. I think he's still sort of, if you hated him, you're going to hate him. And there's a lot of people who hate the NDP in this province. But if you hate the Liberals, you're going to hate the Liberals. And it's that mushy middle that I think is getting tired of the complacency of the BC Liberals. And we saw complacency from Kirsty Clark. So it'll be interesting to see what polling data comes out in the next few days, particularly trying to pick up on this. We have under 2 weeks from the election. We realize that our next show is actually going to be our last show before the election itself. And we'll have to try to decide whether we commit ourselves to actual predictions, because we sort of mentioned some things to Glacier Media, but you know, we were a couple beers in by the time we got there, at least I was, so I was just going, NDP majority, why not?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. There was some initial polling right after the debate that suggests that the NDP may have gained a slight advantage in terms that they got the most overall people who thought they did best. Too Close to Call, one of the Canadian polling aggregators, looked at the question a little differently, which was more the net effect of it. Basically, if you take the difference between the supporters and the people who say you won the debate, what that means, because, you know, people who support someone are generally a little biased towards that person and might say, oh, you know, hey, I support the Liberals, so, you know, I'm a little motivated reasoning here is going to say the Liberals win.
Basically just trying to pull the partisans out of the who won the debate.
Yeah, and of that, Weaver was the only one who actually came out ahead, where more people thought he won the debate than were supporting him initially. The NDP did okay, but a little below that, and the Liberals did a little bit below that.
Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, because most of the time debates don't actually matter that much, despite the fact we've spent maybe 20, 25 minutes talking about this already. A few days from now, no one's probably going to be remembering the debate beyond just the big headlines, and so that narrative that had started a few days ago, plus the effects of the debate, will probably just lead to a lot of status quo, if not sort of continuing that trend towards the NDP, I think, unless we see a big event happen.
I think there were some benefits to both the NDP and the Greens in that neither of the leaders were particularly well known before the writ dropped, and this was kind of their introduction to them, and I think they've both benefited from that, probably Andrew Weaver a little more. At least anecdotally, as I mentioned earlier, that does seem to be the impression I've got from just talking to people, is that once they actually see Andrew Weaver's, they tend to like him a little more than just the Greens as a general concept.
Although there are a couple like red flags that have come up in the last few days for the Greens. There was the sort of Martin Luther King candidate, but who, you know, a white guy who tries to ape a Martin Luther King speech. It was not the wisest thing to do, even if you want to sort of capture that enthusiasm.
The accent was the worst part. The choice of words is defensible, but the accent, yeah, that was pretty bad.
And then there was a weird Twitter exchange by Andrew Weaver the other night where he sort of went after a teacher who is part of the BCTF's exec and made some silly
comments.
And
NDP partisan, too,
yeah,
to be fair.
And
but it did seem a little out of place. I believe she's working for the NDP campaign at the moment, so
yeah,
it's a little...
She had posted that she was doing some leafleting, and beyond that, she's just sort of a wacko on the internet. And he's like, wow, we let this person teach our kids? And you're like, you want to be premier. Maybe just, like, ignore her. Even if, you know, her and other partisans are giving you a hard time, be the adult that you say you were in the debate. And I don't think this story is going to have a lot of legs, but if we have this sort of repeated trend that starts to build up, and I know some people who followed Weaver a bit closer say he sort of does do this on occasion, you could build that sort of, is Weaver got that like Trump-like temperament on Twitter at times, which that's probably the only time people will compare Andrew Weaver and Donald Trump, but it's not a comparison anyone wants.
Moving on to segment two, the Economist Party platform, the Greens finally put out their full platform after kind of trickling it out bit at a time over the last couple weeks.
we've covered, as you mentioned, lots of the planks of this, so there's not a lot of extra material in there that we'll dive too deep in, but it's sort of a good chance to take a look at the platform as a whole, especially in contrast to the other two. Just on raw numbers, I think I joked in the other ones that the other platforms were only like 30 pages, but I just double-checked, and the Liberal platform actually is 129 pages. It's actually the longest. Compare that to the NDP's platform, that's 118. And just by raw page count, the Green platform here is only 97 pages, just a sort of light reading relative. But what I noticed looking at them is the NDP's is a lot of bullet points and talking points, and the Liberals has a nice big font. Maybe for their older readers, if I want to make a joke at their expense, which is probably not appropriate. If you sort of copy-paste that and do a word count, I found there's roughly 25,000 words in both the Greens and the NDP platform versus the 13,000 words, roughly, that the BC Liberal platform was. So there's actually a good amount of content in both the Greens and NDP, just not necessarily actual content, but the potential for content, let's say, versus the Liberals are a little less liberal with their verbiage than the other two.
Although, you could say a picture tells 1,000 words, because they did have a lot of pictures in theirs.
And I didn't account for the BC Liberals Vancouver Island platform, so they did potentially have similar word counts, but this is the most trivial of analysis we can do. So let's actually talk about what's in the Green Party platform, and specifically maybe a bit about their numbers, because that's, I think, what's the most interesting. I speculated earlier, I think in one of our episodes, that Andrew Weaver had made this comment about how he'll balance over his mandate. And I was like, is that a code for he's going to run a deficit? And the answer is yes, he's going to run actually substantial deficits for not this year, because he's sort of got the surplus of the Liberals to run off of. But in 2018-19, the Greens are predicting a $146 million deficit. And in 2019-2020, it'll be sort of a $71 million. But then they'll get it up to $195 million surplus. So overall, it'll be balanced. And they try to reflect this as, you know, we shouldn't balance every year because things change, things happen. You have to sort of account for circumstances. But over the cycle, which they define as a mandate of a government, you should balance. And they're even proposing to put that into law. We've seen a lot of balanced budget laws come from particularly conservative governments. But then this is the first time I've seen it sort of stretch over 4 years and just do an average.
Yeah, well, long-time criticism of the approach that governments take to budgets and the emphasis on balanced budgets is that they pick a arbitrary 365-day period to balance revenues with expenditures, which, you know, is no more or less reasonable than a 200-day or a 900-day period. But it's the sort of thing that it's nice, easy, it fits in with our calendar. But there's no reason it has to be that way. And, you know, economists have argued for a long time that it should be done over the course of a business cycle, which doesn't necessarily track nicely onto a political cycle. But, you know, there's at least a case to be made that a yearly budget isn't necessarily the thing you want to be targeted in for balance. So there's props there, I guess, to moving off that approach. But yeah, as you mentioned, there is the balanced budget law, which, you know, Westminster system is basically useless in that Parliament can't bind the hands of future parliaments, and all they have to do if they want to run a deficit is just add a, for the purposes of this budget, you know, section whatever of the statute is hereby suspended, and that becomes the new law, and that's it. Basically impossible to have force unless you actually put it in the Constitution, and, you know, we all know that's not going to happen.
Well, I will say that the Greens running a deficit isn't necessarily evil. The Trudeau Liberals, I think, managed to kill the sort of everything must be balanced, and that's the only way you can win kind of argument. And no one's even really attacked the Greens on you're going to run deficits and put us into giant debt. During the debate, Christy Clark talked a lot about taxes, 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 and this is a tax and spend budget, even arguably at least more so up front about it than the BCNDPs. And that's what I'll move into next is the numbers in here. The Greens in the first year are proposing to add an extra $1 billion of spending, but next year, that's already jumping to 3.2, and then by the end of it, it'll be an extra $4.4 billion of spending per year, which I'm not opposed to in principle. It's just a very bold sort of step that when Christy Clark talks taxes, 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 this is what she can sort of point to and get people afraid, and fear often drives its votes. But within the Greens' breakdown of what they are going to spend and where they are going to get this funds, they are more detailed to their credit than the BC NDP. And this is sort of why economists like Lindsay Tedds, who we talked to before, are very warm on this budget, let's say, sort of positive about it, say there's a lot of good in there and a lot of detail that they deserve props for. There's still criticisms, of course. No political party can be perfect, of course, even to the economists. And one thing I notice in here is the Greens are talking about all the different ways they'll make money, and they talk about how they'll find $155 million in the first year from internal repurposing, but that suddenly has grown to $460 million 3 years from now, which if internal repurposing to me just means trimming the fat or cutting the waste, you'd expect that number to get smaller. So perhaps they have something different in mind.
That's definitely the fudge factor part of it. And like the BC NDP's platform, which we touched on, you know, it's basically what's needed to make it balance out in the end. So yeah, that's, I think, definitely a weak part on that. And, well, you know, I'm sure after 16 years of a government, there's a few, you know, things you can change and save a little money. But, you know, is it $460 million worth?
Well, and then they're
probably not.
Then they're hoping to get from zero to 150 to $450 million a year from tax shifts and adjustments to tax credits, which it feels like you can tune the tax code. And I know the Greens want to get rid of a lot of boutique tax credits, and I'm pretty in favor of that. But that doesn't seem like the kind of change that will net you more money each year, unless you're finding new boutiques tax credits to get rid of.
It might also be just that as the economy grows, the same tax credits will net you more income at going forward.
Triple, though, in 2 years.
That is a little high.
But the biggest amount of money they're going to get, and the one you can actually believe, is the carbon tax increases. Although, ideally, you'd want to get the carbon tax so high that people would just stop burning carbon, and then that's going to start dwindling. But we are going to still be using carbon for the next while, and the carbon tax is there to sort of discourage you. But in the meantime, you can at least get some money and put it to your green jobs, and that's what they're proposing.
Yeah, and that was actually one thing that really struck me on this one, is that they're ending the revenue neutrality of the carbon tax, which is, you know, I think probably the biggest negative on this whole thing is, or at least as far as their carbon tax plan goes, because, you know, that was one of the main benefits of the BC model of the carbon tax, is that it doesn't net you any additional costs in terms of what your tax bill is at the end of the year, but it does significantly incentivize you to reduce your carbon output. So going off that, you're starting to get those negative effects that an increased tax bill will net you without the offset somewhere else. And they're going to be getting rid of the MSP premiums. I'd rather they just take the extra money they're getting from the carbon tax and use that to offset some of the MSP.
Well, that's just the thing, though. There is no revenue-neutral tax cut or otherwise. It's basically just a redistribution. And the question is, who are you going to give that money to? And so here they're saying they're going to put it into jobs rather than into, in the BC Liberals' cases, corporations and wealthy people pockets, or in...
Well, they did also up the rebate, too.
Trinkets to the poor. The NDP, of course, are saying, let's give more of it to the low-income families. And here the Greens just have a different thing. I'm not as hard on the revenue neutrality must be in there, but I'm glad to see the carbon tax coming up. And at least we're not in an axe the tax debate anymore.
Yeah, the NDP has thankfully finally moved on from that, which I think was definitely a low point for them in the last couple elections. I'm not surprised to see Weaver endorse it, considering he's, and wanted to up it, considering he was one of the architects of the original policy before he got into politics for the Green Party.
Well, one of the places they're going to, the Greens are putting a lot of their money, actually most of the money, is into just this lifelong learning. And I think we didn't really touch much on their education plan, but this is something that they're projecting will go from, you know, $780 million in the first year to $2.9 billion of additional funding in the third year. Because I know the Greens are talking about wanting to bring in free daycare and a lot of extra funding for primary and secondary school, but then, you know, also funding the younger children, also putting money into post-secondary. And I think that's a really smart idea, not just because a professor is positing these ideas of investing in university, but if we want to transition BC to a different kind of economy, a less resource-dependent economy, we need those higher-skilled jobs. We need an educated populace to do that. Every study I've read about the value of educating people shows it to be a really good investment. So kudos to the Greens for throwing lots and lots of money at education.
One of the interesting parts of the platform is where they say they're going to work with the federal government to streamline business and consumption taxes to avoid distorting effects on business investment decision and to promote risk-taking and innovation, which kind of sounds like they're looking at doing something like the HST, but without actually saying they're going to bring in the HST.
That would have been a fantastic question to see happen in the debate. Say, would you try to harmonize our consumption taxes? And point blank, because I imagine Weaver might not have used the words HST because they're now politically toxic in this province, but might have actually made a strong argument for the economic case for it, which was sort of where it initially came from. It was a mess. Let's just not relitigate that. But I'd imagine you'd have Horgan and Christy Clark take the very safe place of saying this has been settled in BC, and this is somewhere the Greens could have actually tried to stand out a bit more and try to bring back the rational arguments rather than the emotional and the political arguments that have ultimately won the day.
Yeah, and you've seen them do that on stuff like bridge tolling, where they are definitely taking the more wonky approach to a policy and trying to sell it on its merits. So yeah, it's nice to see it in there, but it would also be nice if they were highlighting a little more.
I think they're just being politically smart. You know, you don't stand up in a rally and go, we're going to bring back the HST in BC because that will not win you votes. So they may not have a lot of strategists or communications staff, but I think they at least have figured that much out.
Yeah, that and fast ferries are two things you just don't promise anymore.
One thing they are promising, though, is, and Andrew Weaver did bring this up in one of the debates, is moving on from the GDP model and moving to a more balanced measure that takes into account different aspects of well-being. So a lot of economists have talked about how GDP is one measure of the economy. It's just sort of a rough ballpark of how much money is being traded almost. But that doesn't account for inequality. That doesn't count for quality of life or longevity or even other economic factors. And so I think they pitched a, of course, naturally very wonky specific model as how they would measure well-being. And it gets sort of soft praise from economists as like, yeah, this is not a bad idea. There's all kinds of models. None are perfect, but at least they're suggesting something.
Yeah, GDP has a lot of uses, no small part, because it's just the standard and it's nice to have a common metric to compare everything with. But yeah, like you said, it doesn't cover everything. So bringing in some of these other metrics, I think it's definitely a good idea.
It'll also be interesting to see how the hypothetical Green majority government tries to compare itself with the rest of Canada if it's using a different stat. You'll have Statistics Canada still coming out with the standard job growth and GDP numbers, but then BC will be like, oh no, but we're actually 2 points ahead on the magic unicorn scale. Can't you beat that?
Yeah, it's the sort of thing that I can see leading to some political gamesmanship, for sure. If not with the Greens, whoever their successor would be.
Because then you can always just turn back to GDP or whatever other measure. Because as soon as you've opened the door to different measures, and it's a door I'm sympathetic to and supportive of, you can then just find whichever one fits your ideology and just say, well, this is the measure that actually matters. This actually sort of happened in the debate when Christy Clark got hammered for the growth in child poverty. And she said, well, no, by this measure, it's actually gone down by half. But then economists sort of went, okay, you can find a stat that shows positive trends in child poverty in this province, but that doesn't mean it's true because there are different ways to measure it. Some are more valid, some are more useful than others. One other area I saw actually very little on in the Greens platform that I was almost a little surprised was is they had a lot of promises in there, but some were just a bit more vague. Like under their democratic reform, they talked just in one bullet about introducing proportional representation and lowering the voting age to 16. Now, half of that is crystal clear about what it means. I can totally understand what lowering the voting age to 16 is, but introducing proportional representation, I'm sympathetic to and supportive of, but does that mean they're just going to put Bill 2 will be STV is now the system in BC, or will there be another citizens assembly, or will we have a referendum?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell, and that is one of those areas that's a little vague. But that's kind of been a long-standing Green Party bit of vagary. The federal Green Parties have had similarly vague PR promises. But yeah, I completely agree. It would be nice to see a little more clarity on it.
I guess they just don't want to get pinned down in the election on the MMP versus STV debates that bore everyone but policy wonks like us. But I still want to see it, because these are the Greens, and you know they're having the debates, and you know they have preferences. I think generally they're probably sympathetic to STV, since it had the Citizens Assembly and a large amount of support there. But then if they commit to that, they have to say they're sort of going against the two referendums that we had, even though we technically won one of those referendums. I guess it's one of those places where politics actually did beat policy in the Green platform. Well, let's jump into two more quick segments. First off, Trump gets hard on softwood. This week, Donald Trump has announced a tariff on Canadian softwood lumber. This sort of follows a multi-year, well, as long as I can remember, there have been softwood lumber disputes. Like, I grew up in Alberta and we didn't really care, but it was a big issue to BC, I knew at least that much. And it all really comes down to the difference in how trees are harvested in Canada versus the US. Most of our forests are crown-lined in Canada, they're government-owned, and the government basically just has auctions to say who can bid to harvest them. Versus in the US, you have to buy acres and acres or more of wild forest, and then you can do what you want with it, because it's America. But that's a lot more expensive, or at least it's seen to be a lot more expensive. I think the ideal of these markets is that it will be on par, but the U.S. is going to be resentful.
There's, I think, a pretty solid argument to be made that this, you know, is a fairly fair market approach to it. It's just auction off the rights to log, and you know, ideally you'd basically come out with a fairly similar price to what you get in the U.S., but you know, it doesn't always work out that way, and that has led to a long-standing dispute, but the U.S. just doesn't produce enough softwood lumber to meet their demand, so they have to import some anyway, and you know, the end result of this is Trump has just raised the cost of building in the U.S.
That is one way to cool a housing market, except their housing market already overcooled. The very specifics are that tariffs could be up to 24% on Canadian softwood lumber, which, imagine if building a house just got 24% more expensive. You usually have like a 10% cushion for your contingencies and random shit that goes wrong. You've just blown that on all your new construction projects.
Yeah, it's definitely going to hurt Americans a lot. And that's the downside to protectionism, is you usually hurt your own consumers as much or more. But, you know, Trump doesn't seem to be the most up on economics. You know, and economic model of the world basically is pre-Adam Smith. It's so out of date.
Well, and there are lots of barbs thrown between the candidates at the BC election debate. Christy Clark tried to poignantly ask John Horgan, why did you never bring softwood lumber up in question period for any of the multiple years you were leader or before that? I actually did try to check, and the BC legislature's Hansard website is just crap. It's like you have really to click to each single day's debate.
A government website isn't user-friendly. That's so odd.
The House of Commons Hansard website, now we're getting wonky. You can search through the whole thing fairly easily, and I could have checked if he'd said something. Luckily, the political parties pay people, so the NDP were able to pull up a time when John Horgan brought up softwood lumber as like the first item of business. But setting that aside, the sort of debate came down to who's talking about softwood lumber and who's doing anything. And John Horgan said, well, you're not in the legislature, so why would I even ask you? Just kind of a weak response. But then it was, well, what has she actually done to move this along? And what I found even more interesting is, like, no one actually has an answer of what they'll do, because they sort of put it to each other like, oh, what would you do? And it's just like, well, I would stand up for BC softwood lumber, BC timber industry. And you're like, what does that mean, though? Like, and I know they're not going to, like, say exactly what their negotiating tactics are going to be, but just saying I will stand up is so trivial.
And a big part of the problem is it's just not an area of provincial responsibility. International trade is governed by the feds, and they can grandstand as much as they want, but at the end of the day, they just don't have a huge amount of sway.
Well, a couple of things Christy Clark has already said she'd do is, first, she's going to stop accepting U.S. coal coming through BC to our ports.
She's asked the federal government to stop accepting coal because, once again, it's not her decision. But that's actually a policy I quite like, because the problem with trade wars is, you know, it's I'm going to hurt my citizens in the hope that, you know, your producers catch a little heat as a result.
Isn't that the kind of way all wars work? Like, we're going to have some of our people die to hurt some of your people?
Well, usually the hurting the other people is the primary action, and some of your people is kind of the getting hurt is the secondary effect, where trade wars are kind of the opposite, where hurting your people is the primary effect, and if you do a little damage to the other guys, you know, that also might happen. But, you know, this one's actually, I think, a pretty clever response in the way that this is coal that is transiting through Canada on the way to Asian markets, so might hurt the rail company's bottom line, and maybe the Port of Metro Vancouver might take a hit, you know.
And no one has sympathy for any of that, either of them anyway.
Yeah, we're talking, like, if people lose jobs over it, it's five longshoremen maybe. Like, it's not the sort of thing that's going to cause a huge amount of economic damage to Canada the way raising tariffs on autos imports would.
Well, and this also gives Clark a new angle to say she's talking about green energy and saying, look, I'm standing up for lower emission fuels. And this reminds me of another thing she talked about in the debate was like, I'm standing up for LNG for our children. And I think she was putting that to Andrew Weaver, and she sort of kept on it the way, you know, the Simpsons, won't someone think of the children? And on the LNG specifically, it was very disingenuous given the sort of lack of LNG fulfillment of her promises, let's say. But so cutting off U.S. coal, if Trudeau agrees to it, I guess, reasonable counter swing, whatever you do in a trade war. But beyond that, the only other thing she's really proposed is sort of setting up a D.C. trade office for British Columbia, which there's arguments that each provincial premier and premier's office should be regularly communicating with our largest trading partner. I know Rachel Notley's government has spent a lot of time lobbying the U.S. So on the other side, you have Horgan and Weaver not really able to say much more than just, yay, BC jobs, we'll stand up for the forestry sector.
Yeah, there just isn't a huge amount they can do on that. And, you know, they have been not directly related to this, but one of their forestry pitches is trying to stop the raw log export, but I don't really see that changing things at all. And I think as an economic policy, it's a little nonsensical, but like, there just isn't a huge amount you can do on the softwood lumber side as a provincial government. One interesting little thing that's come out in the last couple of days since the softwood lumber announcement was former U.S. Trade Representative Michael Foreman was interviewed on CBC's Power and Politics and made the claim that there was basically a softwood lumber agreement more or less reached between the Canadian and American governments in the final days of the Obama administration, but Canada put it on hold in the hopes that they could get a better deal from Trump. And at this moment, it hasn't been corroborated, but if it is, that's a pretty damaging thing to have happened or to be tarred with as the federal government.
Well, Chrystia Freeland, the Minister of Trade, is denying it outright, as you would. You wouldn't sort of admit that you fucked up that royally.
Especially for something where everybody could tell that Trump was going to be anti-trade.
So it's definitely a he said, she said sort of situation. I think it's interesting on the face of maybe there was a little hope of a different administration doing a sort of different deal, but more realistically, I almost see if they were sort of in the late stages, sort of post-election in the lame duck period almost, Obama was probably under pressure and had a lot of things to try to tie up so that they wouldn't get burnt to the ground. And as important as Canadian trade is to the U.S., it might not have been on the top of his priority list. It might have just sort of sat at the bottom of his inbox going, yeah, I'll get to you, Canada.
Could be, although there was at least one meeting between Obama and Trudeau post-election during the transition period. So that's the sort of thing that could have happened during that time. And, you know, the logic that is presented here on why Canada put it on hold was that Trump was a former developer, so might be a little more sympathetic to the case for cheap building materials. But, you know, it strikes me as pretty weak logic, especially considering all of Trump's Trumpisms and just general anti-trade point of view, that it would seem to be an odd thing to try and gamble on. Anyway, we're going to have to keep an eye out on this one, see if anything more comes out on it. But, you know, if it is true, it could, you know, really come back to bite the Trudeau government.
Well, the one other thing it does sort of hint at is there are a lot of other U.S. trade concerns that have always been bubbling under the surface. We know Trump has talked a lot about sort of investigating security implications around importing steel, and he wants to sort of buffer up the U.S. steel industry. And there was his rhetoric about the Canadian dairy industry, and that's one where there are subsidies for Canadian dairy farmers.
Well, it's not really a subsidy, it's price fixing.
But so these are things that will sort of keep coming up, and it's a question of, was there pressure to try to solve everything at once, or did they torpedo something early in hopes of something better? Just a lot of unanswered questions, I think. And trade deals are always sort of behind closed doors by their nature, so we'll probably never actually know any of these answers.
Well, not until like 50 years from now when all the cabinet documents get released and you know everything gets declassified.
And the most interesting thing of this era is going to be whether Canada torpedoed a trade deal to hope for a better one with Trump. That's it. That's all I'm going to care about in 50 years.
Well, the intelligence, whatever CSIS has on the Trump-Russia connection will definitely be more interesting. A little interesting nonetheless. But yeah, the whole thing is definitely a little uncertain on what's happening, especially in light of Trump's recent flailing about on the NAFTA file, where he was about to sign an executive order announcing the U.S.'s withdrawal from it, but then changed his mind, and it's just a big question mark right now. Okay, moving on to our final main segment, Dryden's Done. Kevin O'Leary surprised everyone yesterday when he dropped out of the Conservative Party leadership race.
This was extra interesting because, as you've received and a few other people, his name's already on the ballot, and iPolitics is sort of tracking of the Conservative leadership member support as best as they can do it. As we mentioned earlier, it's probably the best data you can get. Still puts him in first place of first ballot supporters, but he just decided, no, I quit. And he announced that after meeting with Maxime Bernier that, oh, Mad Max has the most reasonable policies from Mr. Wonderful's point of view.
Which I think is kind of damning with faint praise on that one. But yeah, it was really interesting that this was actually the day most people received their ballots for the Conservative leadership race and can't, and you know, now there's some guy's name on it who can't actually win.
Well, there's at least 13 people's name on it who won't win, but there's a bunch of people who probably won't win. But yeah, now he has chosen not to win. And his name's even on there when I expect he'll probably beat at least 7 people, even not being an official candidate anymore.
But O'Leary's sudden withdrawal definitely kind of throws everything up in the air in a lot of ways, because, you know, the front runner's gone, and, you know, basically within, an hour of the announcement, my phone started buzzing as every other candidate started sending out emails trying to garner O'Leary votes.
Well, and one thing that's been coming up is Andrew Scheer is actually starting to rise in this iPolitics poll. He also somehow came into second place, which now gives him a realistic shot, even though Maxime Bernier still has most advantages, in my view. But Scheer is trying to play that middle ground, and there was even a report that O'Leary met with Scheer, but then O'Leary kind of denies that. And
yeah, though I kind of caution about reading too much into this, as we've mentioned a few times. There's a lot of data issues around the Conservative leadership race, and it's just not a place where good polling is happening. And the fact that Scheer's polling twice of O'Toole's, well, O'Toole's definitely had that kind of momentum for the compromise middle ground candidate, seems a little incongruous. So it does raise some questions on that.
And now it's just all, I guess, going to come down to, will Mad Max run away with it? Like, if he can sweep up most of O'Leary's supporters, because you have to imagine a lot of people who signed up to support O'Leary are not longtime conservative members. These are bandwagon, big name star, or people who went, you know, I'm sympathetic to the conservative, maybe they voted for him, but saw Kevin O'Leary and went, yeah, let's have a TV businessman be our leader.
Because that's working out so well down south.
Well, like, usually when a candidate sort of throws their endorsement to someone else, I wouldn't automatically assume most of those supporters would go that way. You'll get maybe a chunk, but it's sort of a symbolic thing. In this case, I wouldn't be surprised if Bernier is able to pick up a majority or more of those O'Leary supporters, and that gives him a really entrenched advantage.
Yeah, I can see him definitely doing fairly well with that group, because like O'Leary, he's fairly moderate on the social issues, so there isn't that big disconnect there. They're both pretty heavy on the lower taxes and everything. And, okay, that's basically the end of O'Leary's platform, but, you know, there's a lot of kind of similarities there. So I could see him doing fairly well on that and picking up a lot of those. But this is one area I'm just not really super comfortable speculating on, just because I've never quite got the appeal of Kevin O'Leary. Like, there are other people I don't support who I can at least see why other people do, but the O'Leary one was something I've never quite been able to figure out, and consequently I'm not really sure how those people are going to break down when they decide to cast their ballots.
And the other thing I'll just throw in to close off this segment, perhaps, I know a lot of sort of progressive who've been watching the debate with sort of a fear and trepidation that O'Leary is the Trump of this race are sort of ecstatic, or at least relieved, that he's no longer in there. And, well, I'm having this sort of Schadenfreude of, like, watching the pompous douchebag, you know, eat his own humility by being like, yeah, I didn't actually want it anyway. As he realizes he can't speak French.
And can't win Quebec.
And can't win Quebec. But O'Leary's always struck me as less dangerous, almost, than Trump. He's still bombastic and all of that, but he doesn't sort of go leaning into the racism and the xenophobia and the misogyny in the same way.
Well, Trump has two big things against him. The just sheer ignorance and the xenophobic nationalism. And with the conservative race, that's kind of split between O'Leary taking the completely ignorant of anything related to government at all side of it, and Kelly Leach, and to a slightly lesser extent, Blaney and Lemieux, taking the nationalism, you know, some xenophobia side of things.
My basic advice to progressives is don't be too happy about this, because there's still a lot of terrible people in this race. Not to make you feel better about it, but O'Leary leaving does make me happy, but his chance of winning was always not that high. Like, he had a better than most chance, but with this many people in the field and all the undecideds we're talking about, the path is difficult for him to sort of beat the 50%, but the path for a Leach, or even a Bernier, who recently got endorsed by Senator Lynn Bayek, who was the residential schools, were actually kind of fun. Senator who was recently also removed from the Aboriginal Affairs Committee for saying such things. But Bernier's sort of response to this was, oh yeah, well, maybe political correctness has gone too far and she should just say whatever she wants, and not sort of endorsing her comments, but sort of applauding her for saying them, which always makes me go, oh, I don't like libertarians at all. And sort of if you add on to that, I guess even Michael Chong sort of highlighted the extremism of the Maxime Bernier platform in the debate last night that I'm pretty sure no one watched, because there have already been a bunch of conservative leadership debates.
Even people who are paying attention to the conservative leadership race are getting pretty bored of them by now.
Well, and they're impossible to watch with 14 candidates, or I guess 13 last night. And it was on the same time as the BC leadership debate, so at least the only province we care about was watching that. But I guess Chong had a really good sort of takedown of how extreme this platform was, of Bernier's, talking about just how, you know, Harper cut government by 2 or 3%, but Bernier wants to cut like a third of the government. there's the Overton window of, like, Canadian politics, and Bernier's so far out of it that he will realistically scare a lot of Canadians.
That's the thing I think Bernier's going to have a lot of trouble with, Jody Wynn, is pivoting towards a general election. And his response to those questions so far is, you know, I don't compromise on my values, but you can only pull people so far off of their natural spot on the political spectrum towards your side, and he has a long way to pull people.
Well, and it's sort of like the Nikki Ashton ideological left-wingism, only the polar opposite. And I can see the appeals for the ideologues of those. Like, I have sympathies there, and I'm like, I want that to be acceptable, but I know it won't win. And I don't want him to be acceptable, and I know he won't win. But I also don't want him to become leader, because that means we have to spend a lot of time debating about libertarianism, and that's so exhausting.
Well, I'd at least rather that than having to debate whatever Brad Frost wants to bring up, or Kelly Leach. So, as far as it goes, you know, the just what should government be doing is a better argument to be have than just who should government be oppressing.
Well, Bernier's argument is, should there be a government to some extent? But we'll cross those battles when we have to get to them.
But yeah, that does bring up the question of who's best suited to actually face Trudeau in the next election. And, you know, there was one poll that Abacus put out, which was more or less useless because everything was clumped around the margin of error. And
those polls are kind of useless this far out when it's sort of just a speculative, no one's really paying attention to who these people are anyway, outside of political wonks and the Conservative Party membership. And even then, most people couldn't name them all.
And I basically agree it's useless, but I do think they more or less place people, with the exception of Kevin O'Leary, who shouldn't. Like, the ranked order actually seems fairly reasonable, except for O'Leary and Leach's position on there. But, yeah, I just can't see the Conservatives doing particularly well with Maxime Bernier as leader. That sort of ideologue just doesn't go over well in Canada. You know, we like principle, but not stubbornly principled above all other things.
Pragmatic principled.
Yes, and Bernier definitely doesn't have the pragmatic part of that nailed down. I think if they were smart, they'd probably go with either Chan, Shearer, or Toole. I think those three, actually Wright too, would probably do fairly well in a general. I'm not sure those last two really have the campaigning chops to go against Trudeau, but at least they aren't likely to push away a good chunk of the Canadian population. But it's going to be a hard call, and we're going to have to see how that shades out. Just the as we mentioned, the ballots just got mailed out, and they'll be voting till the 27th of May when it gets announced.
So will you be sharing your own personal ranking at any point?
Well, I think basically anyone who's listened to the podcast knows who's getting my number one choice, but I actually haven't figured out exactly where I'm going to be putting out the next 9 people I can put on.
All right, well, maybe we'll come back to that after the BC election, or even after the Conservatives, and show our cards. My non-Conservative ballot would have a Chong, O'Toole, and then maybe just go blank.
Not even Lisa Raitt?
Maybe, but it's sort of a throwaway ballot. Maybe I just put Deepak Obrai number one and just leave it blank down the rest. Who knows? I don't have to make these tough choices. But let's close off the show, as we're running a bit long, with a few quick takes. So first, Justin Trudeau's once again put his foot in his mouth. It's been a couple weeks at least since he's made a major gaffe. This time he went on Vice News on a sort of town hall discussion to talk about cannabis legalization, which is borderline peak Vice. But to Vice's credit, they actually got a lot of well-informed people, from what I've heard, to ask some pretty good questions. One specific person came up and said, gave sort of a personal story and talked about people he knew or family he knew who was arrested for pot offenses, and asked sort of why won't Trudeau decriminalize or at least reduce the sort of criminalization in the meantime while we move towards legalization. And Trudeau, for whatever reason, decided to talk about when his brother got arrested for pot offenses, and then his dad, the prime minister, maybe not the prime minister at that time.
Either prime minister or ex-prime minister.
Yeah, dad, fairly influential, got him off. And so he gets it. So he understands the trouble only he's just not going to do anything about it.
The whole thing was just remarkably tone-deaf. There's been a persistent criticism on the lack of decriminalization on the way to legalization, and the, hey, people in my family haven't, you know, have gotten in trouble, but not really, because we get them off, does the exact opposite of reassure people on this.
It's like he almost recognized his privilege and then just went, yeah, that's what life's like. And it's so blind, you're right, it's so tone-deaf. He spent the rest of that town hall talking a lot about public safety. He got criticized for using possibly racialized language around protecting you from strangers in stairwells and talking a lot about the criminal aspects of pot without talking about the liberty or the, not even the possible medical benefits, which can be debated on their own, but just why are we throwing people in jail for something that's not really that harmful and most people are on board with?
Well, the latest in the UN's continual campaign to not be taken seriously as a global organization, the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women has a new member, Saudi Arabia, which, you know, is basically like putting North Korea at the top of the, you know, UN Committee on Democracy.
A few years ago, I remember Saudi Arabia, I think, was given the chair of the Human Rights Committee, and it's the same sort of hypocrisy bullshit. Like, I get that some of these committees just sort of rotate memberships and rotate chairs internationally, but it feels like there should be some core value or sort of
minimum standard.
Yeah, like actual commitment to the mission of the group before you can get, like, prove it. Like, come on, Saudi Arabia. You don't belong there. No one thinks you do. There's not a lot to say about this. This is a bullshit story and shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, I completely agree. But yeah, as you mentioned, this is just kind of one in a long series of those sorts of questionable UN decisions, and well, this didn't exactly gain traction with the current Conservative Party leadership races. So some of the other UN faux pas definitely have, and it's stuff like this is why you don't see a universal love of the UN in Canada.
Well, speaking of the United Nations, the Liberal government has formally, officially, I guess, signed, joined the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. This is a sort of agreement that the UN has come to for member states to recognize rights of Indigenous people. This is something that's a lot like rights of the children and other guiding principles, not necessarily legally enforced doctrines, but ways that we should try to negotiate between people. And Canada, being a colonial state, sort of had never fully endorsed it. And it's not something you really sign, but Canada's always been a bit hesitant on it because it does say that Indigenous people should have the right to free prior informed consent before the sort of colonial government moves in on their land. And in Canada, that becomes an issue where a lot of the country, or where big parts of the country, especially here in BC, are unceded territory, meaning the colonists and the British and Europeans who came over never actually came to treaties, even under their sort of British law where they just assumed they were better and they're like, here's three beads, give us your land. We don't even have that. They just, and they didn't even fight a war over it where there was then a peace treaty saying, you give up your land and we've taken it. They just, white people just started moving here and it got awkward and that's the situation. So Canada has now officially removed our objection to that section. Carolyn Bennett, the Minister of Indigenous Affairs, sort of her response was, oh, we thought it was pretty clear that we didn't have a problem with that when we sort of talked about signing on to it a couple of years ago. And it never really was, because the federal government is talking about pushing pipelines through against the consent of some Indigenous groups. And so this is sort of a step towards reconciliation. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out over time, but it makes the Liberals look a little less hypocritical about their pledge to enact the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's recommendations when they were still sort of pushing back against UN DRIP.
Yeah, well, I guess we're just going to have to see on how this shapes out in terms of the actual policy implications and, you know, whether that means, you know, full-on veto over every, you know, potential project or anything else, because I believe the current Canadian law is doesn't actually grant veto powers to the Aboriginal communities that are affected by these projects. So that can have a pretty big set of ramifications, and it's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
And I said these aren't legally binding, but I think our courts do look to international agreements that we've signed to for some guidance, and they can refer to them. I'm sure it will come up in the courts, and we'll find out then. Or maybe we'll just have to bring Micah or one of our other lawyer listeners on to dispel the myths for us.
And finally, Victoria wants the provincial government to expand the foreign buyer's tax to include, well, Victoria. The current one only covers Metro Vancouver, and Christy Clark was so helpful to point out, from Langley to the Strait of Georgia. But, you know, Victoria's also had some issues with rising house prices, and while the other parties have promised to bring it in province-wide, the Liberals haven't, and the Victoria city government wants them to do it in Victoria as well.
Assuming the problem that this tax is set out is real and is significant,
which is still a bit debated, and we just don't have good data on.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then just applying it to Metro Vancouver immediately pushes that capital elsewhere in the province and elsewhere in the country to some extent. So expanding it just makes sense. If this is a problem and this is how we want to try to solve it, then we should at least be consistent. Because once you've created a bubble where that money is pushed out, it's going to go elsewhere. Well, this is right in line with the BC Greens platform, and the Greens are the strongest on Vancouver Island, so they mesh and play off each other with this.
Yeah, I see the Greens capitalizing on this for sure. I mean, we still have the underlying question of how much of an effect does it actually have, and you know, as we mentioned last week, I believe, the early data suggests that the effects have more or less worked themselves out, and home prices are back on the rise, if at a slightly slower rate, so it remains to be seen if this will have much effect in Victoria.
So all our foreign wealthy listeners who may or may not exist, now's maybe your last chance to buy a home without paying 15% more in the city of Victoria.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politicos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.